We present the News Quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello! Welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from a tourist information website in Australia, read by Kathy Clugston.
Beach snorkeling at Heron Island. Being right on the reef means that you can snorkel off the beach. If you haven't snorkelled before or would like to practice, try Shark Bay.
Our thanks to Lindsay Gaskell in Moorooka, Queensland, for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Really welcome first, on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Helen Lewis. And opposite them, on my left, Katie Brand and Andy Zaltzman. Jeremy, who's been behaving in an uncharitable manner?
OK, let's give the miserable story to the dreary old didactic one. various NGOs have the problem, or perhaps have created or engendered or tolerated the problem of some of their workers in the field misbehaving very, very badly. Now, when you've got an enormous organisation with a reputation it wants to protect, historically, that person has been moved to another parish or to... or to Radio 2. In this case, you can simply move them to another disaster zone. Oh, look, come on, that was Chad. This is Haiti. I mean, come on. What's the likelihood he's going to carry on in the same way? Now, some of these things have been denied, but some people seem to be sort of saying, this is normal behaviour. At the end of the day, in this situation, everyone's under a bit of stress and they kind of need to kick back. And you think, I know there's going to be an element of adventurism and machismo and the kind of white saviour complex among some of the people, which gives them a sense of entitlement. But I don't think every good act needs to have an equal and opposite reaction. I mean, I don't think we as humans think, oh, God, that's so much philanthropy I've done today. I just need to exploit the vulnerability of a young woman to just kind of balance things out a bit. It just seems a peculiar... But maybe it is human nature. I mean, earlier today, they were collecting for Great Ormond Street to Victoria Station. And the minute I dropped the pound in the bucket, I thought, oh, no, I shouldn't have done that. Now I'm going to have to expose myself to a party of school children. Just to kind of unwind after a spasm of philanthropy and giving. I mean, obviously, we're often stressed out in these situations. Take matters into your own hands is what I would say. We can all, you know, or just get drunk or beat your head against the wall or smoke dope, whatever you need to do. But there is this idea that women sort of do this by choice. Ultimately, all of our decisions are a choice, but I think it's stretching the meaning of choice, really. People say, well, some women enjoy being prostitutes. Well, some people like being peed on, but I don't think you can make that assumption about them the first time you meet them, really. And there's all this mythology, oh, there is a happy hooker, the belle du jour, lady of the night, who enjoys it. And you think, well, that is like three people in the world. And those people are used as cover for all of the horrible abuse of all the other women. It's like being the one bondage freak in Guantanamo who finds it all very empowering. That's what I reckon.
I think Jeremy's got it exactly right, which is that you do get this strange attitude that people are conducting essentially penis-based philanthropy by sleeping with sex workers, right? Like, they're doing a wonderful favour to the local economy, which is just not true.
I'll have sex with you, I'll give you money and you can feed your children. You say, well, how about you just give them the money and don't have sex with them? And then they can still feed their children and nobody's an arsehole.
And they've got a bit more spare time as
yes.
well. I guess, you know, we have to look for positives. I'm a sports fan. I therefore know that even in the most dark and disastrous situation, you can find some spurious positives. And Haiti had been really out of the news. And you know, fair play to Oxfam for, you know, making people remember quite what a disaster zone it is. I mean, maybe not the best way they could have gone about that, but let's judge it by the outcome, not the journey.
This is the Oxfam scandal, which has seen the charity rocked by allegations of serious misconduct. It's such a shame that this has undermined all the genuinely helpful Oxfam employees, without whose assistance so many of us would simply have no way to gratify our desire to dress up in the used clothes of old women. As with all other organisations in this sort of mess, Oxfam have pledged to carry out a systematic root and branch review, taking testimony from everyone involved before briefly sacking Tony Blackburn for reasons no one fully understands. We currently spend 0.7% of our GDP on foreign aid, which seems extraordinary given that we can barely afford these series of bridges that spring into the mind of Boris Johnson whenever he sees an unobstructed horizon. 2 points to Jeremy. Helen, who thinks Valentine's Day is all about leaving?
This must be Boris Johnson, our foreign secretary, who used Valentine's Day to give a speech about his roadmap to Brexit. And his roadmap to Brexit basically consists of a big sign that says Brexit will be great, and then nothing else at all. The speech was incredibly boring. I thought, you know, the worst thing about a Boris Johnson speech was it was going to be packed full of terrible jokes, but he managed to only do one joke about sex tourism. I mean, that's for him, that's a kind of a statesman-like thing to do. But it was in a really extraordinary speech because he tried to get this idea that, you know, everything's going to be brilliant after Brexit because we'll still be able to go on cheapo stag do's to ancient cities, he said. And I just thought, this is it, isn't it? This is, you know, we're talking about trade policy and the only thing we can think about exporting is pissed up lads from Darlington dressed as Smurfs. That's it. That's all we've got left now on the global stage. So, it wasn't my favourite. It was No, I Have a Dream. Let's put it that way.
The whole point of Boris Johnson is that he's supposed to be quite good value, sort of larger than life and quite funny. And he managed to be none of those things. He was really sweaty. He was really scared. The only thing he's got from going from is tremendous self-belief and hubris. You know, he just walked through a life where anyone gets in your way, that the beaters just sort of deal with them quietly. You know, it's put down as an accident. You know, but he was sweating. He looked flustered. Something's gone wrong, hasn't it? I think maybe he's been found out by himself. He's clearly a very he's a clever man, and he's finally figured out that he is useless.
Andy. I was rather intrigued by Boris saying that Brexit was not a V sign from the cliffs of Dover, which incidentally is my favourite Vera Ling. But also, I think, to be honest, I think that is what we voted for, isn't it? I'm sure it was in some of the campaign literature I got that they would build a giant V sign at the cliffs of Dover that would be about a kilometre and a half high, visible from all points on continental Europe, that could be then used with a large elastic bands to fire illegal asylum migrants back wherever they came from. That is what we voted for.
And do you think Valentine's Day is a good day for Boris to be making a speech? Because this is one of a series. There's going to be lots and lots of speeches about the road to Brexit. And then they're going. Boris's speech is a prelude to a. This sounds really fun. A cabinet away day.
Could they lengthen that out to a year, maybe?
I'm surprised that Boris Johnson hadn't got a lot on Valentine's Day. I mean, he must have a lot to keep on top of. As it were.
Maybe that's why he was so sweaty.
I don't feel like this is anything even to do with Brexit anymore. I just feel like the country's now locked like the Norse gods in a battle between Jeremy Hunt, George Osborne, Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, who through their whole lives and boyhoods have all individually decided that at some point they're going to be Prime Minister. And they can't all be Prime Minister. And they're sort of realising that one of them, the outside chance two of them might become Prime Minister. And now it's just the four of them kind of battling it out. And it's nothing really to do with the country anymore. So we should put the four of them in a room for as long as it takes until one of them wins and they can come out and be Prime Minister for a month and then they can get executed. And then we can just put this whole thing behind us. I mean, yes, I think that sounds eminently reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a shame if this ended in no executions, wouldn't it? Yes.
But, just over a year now until the trapdoor is catapulted on the 29th of March, if all goes according to the current schedule. Admittedly, that is the biggest if since Rudyard Kipling started projecting the titles of his poems onto the night skies above Gotham City. 29th of March. That's a great anniversary. That's the anniversary of the Battle of Towton in 1461, which is the single bloodiest day of fighting in the history of these islands. 28,000 people killed in a single day of hand-to-hand combat. You just have to admire the logistics of that and the work rate of our youngsters back in 1461. I don't think they'd do it. I don't think we'd kill each other in those numbers these days. Our youngsters would take one look at that battlefield and say, no, I'm not doing that. We'd have to hire in a load of Poles to kill each other.
But it's because of the health and safety madness of the EU that we haven't been able to have those battles.
This is Boris Johnson's big Brexit speech, his Valentine's Day gift to the nation. Johnson tried to assure the public that Brexit can be grounds for hope rather than fear. You know, as in that popular phrase, a tremendous hope of the unknown. This is supposed to be one of a number of speeches by members of the Cabinet on Brexit to arrive in the coming days, so plenty to look forward to. I can't wait to see what Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, David Lidington, comes out with. There won't be a dry seat in the House. The Foreign Secretary delivered very much a greatest hit speech, a few off-colour gags, a dash of Latin, and some unnecessarily long words. All he needed to do to complete the set was zipline off the stage and into somebody else's wife. Boris argued, we as a nation should unite around the things we all believe in. If the last few years have taught us anything, there is absolutely nothing that we all believe in. Other than it was a bit sad when the lady on the ice skates fell over. Boris did say that Brexit does not involve giving a V sign from the White Cliffs of Dover, although he hasn't ruled out mooning from the window of a speeding Eurostar. 2 points to Helen. Katie, which party is looking after the political animals?
Well, this is an announcement from Labour, from the Labour Party, about a new set of animal welfare policies that they would like to introduce, were they to be in government. And they're really playing to their industrial heartlands by banning foie gras. Wooing back all those voters. Maybe Jeremy Corbyn spent slightly too long in Islington now, perhaps, if that's his main priority. But he's banning foie gras and badger culling and a whole load of other things, which sound very nice, which is very good. I mean, you can't argue with animal welfare. You can't actually, as I'm finding, be especially funny about animal welfare. You just have to say it's a really, really good idea and then shut up, because otherwise Twitter is not a nice place to be for a bit. But yeah, it is good. It's nice. It's obviously, who could argue with this? Let's be nicer to animals. No, boo. Of course, it's really nice. It's a really nice thing to do. They've suggested that, like, for example, it's difficult for generation rent, as the millennials are called, shut out of the housing market. So they have to rent, but then they can't have pets because it's very difficult to have a pet in a rented house. The landlord won't allow it, so you'll be allowed to have pets, which is lovely. It's like, you know, you can't buy a house, but here's this puppy. That's very nice. But the trouble is that the elephant in the room, the well-cared-for elephant in the room, is that we still don't know what Labour's position on Brexit is. And that sort of people suspect that maybe they're more in favour of Brexit than a large number of their voters and members would like. So it sort of feels a bit sleight of hand, this. It feels slightly dishonest that they're sort of doing something nice to mask the sort of horror that's to come. A little bit like, you know, when your boyfriend has sex with you one last time before they dump you. Do you know what I mean?
That's my second favourite Vera Lynn song.
We'll meet again. You'll never get animal welfare past rural voters because people in the countryside, that's animal cruelty is what they live for. They just make things up and say that they're sport. Is it? Well, rambler dissolving has been something that rural people have engaged in for many years. And the ramblers enjoy it and the acid works in seconds and it's more humane than beating them to death with pool cues.
The badger cull, I mean, it'd be disappointing to lose the traditional British sport of badger culling. But, I mean, it's a lot of it, as so often in politics, is sort of vengeance-driven. It's a blood feud between humans and badgers in this country. That goes back to when the badgers crucified Queen Boadicea, of course. So. I do worry, though, that having attempted this badger cull, it's just going to be a generation of radicalised badgers now with a kind of vengeance against us.
Well, the nice thing about it is it marks, a new era of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, because this is just a complete... Utter cynicism from him, right? I'm not saying that he hates badgers. I wouldn't go that far. But I don't think he has evinced a huge love of badgers in his career so far. But they know at the last election that some of the stuff that really hurt the Tories was the ivory ban that was in the manifesto and also fox hunting. So in the run-up to the local elections, it's basically hug a badger, hug a lobster, hug a big can of foie gras.
Get the badger-owning renter vote, all of these things.
Are we looking at votes for badgers? Is that where this is heading?
Well, that's what it says.
Where will it end?
I think they'll bring it all together and they'll offer millennials council houses with pet badgers.
This is how policies are formed.
This is the news that the Labour Party have drawn up a new policy platform on animal welfare, committing them to improving provisions for pet owners, creating new systems to prevent cruelty, and joining the Conservatives in recognising animal sentience. And in a world of rampant economic uncertainty, where the housing crisis is biting harder than ever before, it's a relief to find our two major parties standing as one in the belief that chickens have feelings. The document is called Animal Welfare for the Many, Not the Few, suggesting that Labour are maintaining their long-standing position of treating the white rhino as an overprivileged elite. The proposals apply to most animals other than cats, who are described in the document as neoliberal Blairite scrum who are only in it for themselves. I said scrum, not scum, there. That's upsetting. I'll do that again. And, do you mind a note? Enjoy it more. There we are. The proposals apply to most animals other than cats, who are described in the document as neoliberal Blairite scum who are only in it for themselves. Guys, please, no, I've got more to read out. Labour will guarantee affordable vet care for those on low income, suggesting that in years to come, the only way most of us will be able to get our tonsils out is by dressing up as a bull mastiff. 2 points to Katie. Andy, who couldn't persuade others to share?
Any parent? Well, this would be the Northern Ireland continuing its heroic efforts to not have a functioning government, which I think is a blueprint for the future of humanity, essentially. They've had 400 days now with no government after the collapse of the latest power-sharing talks. I was there the other day in Belfast, and it seemed to be working fine. And it leads me to believe maybe, I mean, do we need a government? I mean, governments seem to really, really piss people off. And Belgium had a go, they had over a year with no government, and France have elected basically a 3D printout of a void. this seems to be the way that politics is going. So I think in some ways this is a laboratory experiment. And it will be rolled out across the country, and we will just have like an empty... There'll just be a bucket in Westminster, and nothing will happen, and everyone will be happy. This is the utopia that we're entering.
Is there anything in the bucket, Chris?
No.
It's a symbol.
Don't spoil the bucket, Miles.
There's almost no end to the ridiculousness of it. So the current situation is that you have a First Minister and Deputy First Minister from two different parties. So the idea has always been DP and Sinn Féin. But if we take it back into Britain, it becomes Karen Bradley is both of them. She's both First Minister and Deputy First Minister. She has to power share with herself.
The DUP seem incredibly sanguine about the return of direct rule, I suppose, because Northern Ireland will be ruled, like the rest of the United Kingdom, by the DUP. Which puts them very much in the driving seat. But it's all to do with the Ash for Cash thing and also gay marriage, which they will not break because of the sodomy and an affront to God and nature. But also there is this sticking point of language, because the native language, the historic language of Ireland, surprisingly, is called Irish. But the DUP... They said, no, we have our own language. If the Catholics have their language of Irish, we have our language of Ulster Scots. Now, Ulster Scots or Alans is a bit hard to explain. You know the language English? It's exactly the same as that. Except it's spoken in a Ballymena accent. That's all that happens. But because of the peace agreement, all public sector jobs are advertised in the three languages, and this is entirely true. Some friends of mine who live in Rostreva in County Down, they sent me a jobs advert from the local paper, and the job was for a teacher for children with special needs. And it said that in English, it said in Irish, and in Ulster Scots it said, "Teacher wanted for wee dafties."
This is the collapse of the Northern Irish power-sharing negotiations, which could mean direct rule from Westminster, although that might not be such a bad outcome for the DUP, given that they're currently able to bring down the entire British government if someone so much as asked them to march more quietly. You have to wonder what Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness might make of this from the afterlife, but to be honest, they're probably still getting over the shock of finding each other in the same place. Theresa May visited Northern Ireland this week alongside Irish Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. In order to make the trip, Varadkar had to cancel a previous engagement with Welsh First Minister Carwyn Jones, who once again spent Pancake Day alone, scooping Nutella out of the jar with his sad, lonely fingers. 2 points. To Andy. And at the end of round one, the scores are Jeremy and Helen have 4, and so too do Katie and Andy. We start round two with an extract from the New York Times in an article about the discovery of a World War II bomb that closed London's City Airport earlier this week.
An airport in London was shut down on Sunday night when an unexploded bomb was discovered during construction work. Navy bomb disposal experts were expected to detonate the device on Tuesday in a controlled explosion at the bottom of the Thames, one of the least populated areas of the capital.
Our thanks to Dr. John Orr, Charles Nguyen and Fred King in Maryland for sending us that. Jeremy, have a listen to this.
Turn out the lights. The party's over. They say that all good things must end. Call it a night.
Jeremy, who is zooming off into the sunset?
This is Jacob Zuma, who is no longer the president of South Africa, and it's now Cyril Ramaphosa, who isn't much better. And it's very sad to me, this, because the ANC, people of my generation in our late 50s, these people were heroes. When I was a young student, the ANC was a liberation movement that was revered around the world. But these people have all turned out, I suppose... Things go wrong with national liberation movements. I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa is a billionaire. He's basically turned the South African trade union movement, of which he was a great leader. He's just turned it into the plaything of mine owners. And you think these people didn't start out like that. What happens? And I think in a national liberation struggle, unless you win it outright and rout the oppressor, what happens is a kind of Stockholm syndrome where you get groomed and told how clever you are and that you've been admired and you get gradually lured into it, and the next minute you're an incredibly corrupt, very, very rich man with no interest in his country's welfare. 2 points, thanks.
This thing that you're describing, though, happens to everyone. Like Charlie Brooker, who's a brilliant writer and comedian, described this in terms of being a TV presenter, obviously on a much smaller scale than Zuma. But, you know, like the first day you do a TV presenting job, a runner comes to you and says, can I get you a coffee? And you go, oh, no, I'll get my own coffee. Don't worry about that. And then the next day a runner comes to you and says, can I get you a coffee? And you go, well, actually, I am quite busy, so actually it would be really helpful if you could. Thanks very much. Day three, you arrive and you're just like, where the hell is my coffee?
You think it's like that after just 2 terms of government? You feel that you'd get to that sort of point of
Yeah, probably,
craziness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it only took me 3 days to shout at the runner, so...
I was interested in something Jacob Zuma said. The ANC will govern until Jesus returns. Now, I'm not a God-fearing man, and that feeling is entirely mutual. I think if Jesus does return, I'm not sure being the government of South Africa is going to be particularly high on his priority list. Is it? He's not going to have other stuff to do.
Did he not just mean as an end date rather than that's who we're holding the role
for?
Oh,
I didn't read it like that at all, Miles. No.
My favourite Zuma fact is the fact that his Zulu name is one who smiles while grinding his enemies. Which, yeah, well, exactly. It either sounds very scary or very erotic.
This is the news from South Africa, where Jacob Zuma has finally resigned the presidency. Of course, we have sympathy with South Africa, given that we are ourselves still emerging from the long shadow of our own Mandela, the former Secretary of State for Transport, Stephen Byers. He led us to freedom. We walk forever in his footsteps. The new president is Cyril Ramaphosa, a trade union leader and multimillionaire businessman, or to put it another way, a really, really bad trade union leader. Zuma has been accused of whipping up racial tensions to cover economic failure, but didn't have the sense to throw in the word teleological and be mistaken for a bit of a character. 2 points to Jeremy. Helen, which heir might, after all, be going spare?
This must be the story about the Commonwealth, of which Her Majesty the Queen is currently the head. But I had no idea that when she dies, unfortunately, it doesn't automatically go to Prince Charles, which is kind of mind-blowing. I thought the whole point of hereditary monarchy was that no matter how few chromosomes they'd got or whether or not they last had a chin back in the 1500s, you kind of got whichever one was, you know, there when the music stopped. But but apparently not. No, there's going to be some kind of special election to work out. So it could be. I mean, the trouble with politics at the moment is my friend has an idea of the politics, which says we're living by the banter heuristic, right? Which is whatever is the most banter thing to happen is the thing that inevitably ends up happening. So by this, I do not know who is the next head of the Commonwealth. It would be. It could be you. I mean, I don't know how you feel about
it.
Should
point out that Helen is looking at me at this point. The one thing that is ignored in when we all talk about Britain's relations with the world and the Commonwealth, isn't there a big sort of... It's all kind of slavery and genocide. That's the thing that we know. We pretend it's all just trade and visits and amusing royals with hilarious dances in grass skirts, but it's grim stuff.
Don't be like this in the interview, Jeremy. Absolutely suicidal approach to a job interview.
Can it literally be anyone? It doesn't even have to be a member of the royal family. Could I smell a new reality show?
This is all predicated on the Queen dying. She's not going to die, is she?
No way.
The thing that keeps her going, she looks at her son every day and thinks, no.
We keep singing her theme tune as well. It becomes scientifically impossible for her to die.
There's a lot of talk about humans becoming part robot and android in the future, but what if the Queen is at the cutting edge of that and has had a kind of robotics lab in Buckingham Palace for the last 50 years, and she is an android?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm straying into David Icke territory.
No.
A robot monarch is an achievable goal. I mean, that's... Because
yes.
The range of skills it has to perfect... Mm-hmm.
What is, so they've got to
open a supermarket, wave.
So what's keeping you busy these days?
Yep. Yeah,
and not sing Deutschland über alles in public. That's quite easy to program.
It's not difficult code, is it?
Is the more pressing question not whether or not there will be a Commonwealth? Because post-Brexit, surely it will be an empire again. Is this not what we voted for? Empire Mark II?
That's the worst thing, is that one of the things that Brexit say all the time is, you know, can you name your MEP? Can you name every country in the Commonwealth? I mean, no one can. I mean, I'd hazard a guess at India.
Australia, maybe?
Canada.
Right,
and then...
That must be most of them, mustn't it?
There's like another 45.
We don't know stuff anymore. We all used to know.
Remember, come on, Brandon, tell us.
No, there used to be. We used to all know, like, what leaves go with what trees. I mean, not that you try and put them back on, but do you know that? I mean, my late father would be appalled by my inability to identify British bird life by its plumage. I was walking on a beach in Orkney. I was on Orkney earlier this year. And there was this big, weird duck in the sea, huge thing, black and white, through a drake. And there was a dog walker. I assume she was a dog walker. She had a small bag of shit. strangely, no dog. But anyway, I didn't ask. It wasn't my business. I assure you, it wasn't. It wasn't my business. Anyway. I said, excuse me, do you know the name of that? She said, that's an eider. And, you know, I just had never put it together that an eider was a kind of bird and that the eider down that we used to sleep under was stuffed. I just didn't, and apparently a duvet is a kind of grebe. I didn't know the difference between a cormorant and a shag, because you can get into a lot of trouble if you get that one.
This is a secret meeting of a high-level group within the Commonwealth of Nations who are thought to be deciding whether Prince Charles will automatically succeed his mother as the Commonwealth's head. Prince Charles has attempted to reach out to the Commonwealth member states for support, although it's hard to imagine that the people of Malawi will warm to a man who thinks £6 is a reasonable price to pay for a small packet of biscuits. If the inevitable happens before a suitable successor has been found, the position will be temporarily filled by the most regal-looking corgi. Monty, for my money, but I know we all have favourites. Of course, everybody's got their own favourite head of the Commonwealth, but for me, it will always be Sylvester McCoy. 2 points to Helen. Katie, who's selling off A Guide to Getting Off?
Oh, well, no, OK, this was a favourite story of mine of this week, which was the discovery of a Georgian sex manual. Yes. Jane Austen suddenly takes on a whole new light once you've seen this. It's come up for auction, I think. It's called Aristotle's Masterpiece. I don't think Aristotle had anything to do with it, but it was around in the 1700s, but was banned, possibly banned until quite recently, although there wasn't a copy of it, so no one really knew or cared. But it is brilliant. It's this amazing manual about sex and lots of tips and advice. And the reason I think it was banned is that it was just full of these kind of lusty images and pictures of wood carvings and descriptions of women lying with beasts. good advice as well for having children. It said that the woman should try to imagine the face of the child that she wanted whilst having sex with her husband in order to conceive, and that if you imagine bad things, then that's what your child would look like.
Miles, I think it's right that your kids look eerily like Mike Atherton's cover drive, don't
they? off the back foot, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Pitched up outswinger.
And there's lots of kind of quite practical advice. Apparently, you should, before you do anything, you should invigorate your mutual desires and get your flames to burn, because this will end up in much more mutual enjoyment. Whereas, you know, now it's like, you know, you share a bottle of red wine, have a quick fiddle, fall asleep, and wake up wondering if you dreamt it. You know, I think there's a lot to be learned from this. I'm glad it's back in the public domain.
Andy. Is it only what the woman is thinking of, imagining during the act?
Yeah, you have to imagine, it says you have to imagine your husband's face. It sort of slightly implies that you're not with your husband when you're conceiving the child. But you have to imagine your husband's face very clearly so that the child will look like your husband.
That's what I got from it. It sounded a bit like a Dear Deirdre in waiting, right? Which is, I accidentally imagined the postman's face, and that's why my son looks so different. It had that slight air about it.
That was a scientific reason, they said, why you shouldn't have lie with animals, was because the last thing you see is what you give birth to. And they had a picture, didn't they, of this child born in Italy with wings and a single bird foot. And it wasn't a photograph, obviously, it was a drawing.
I think the lesson is, don't try and do it with a KFC bucket for one.
That is my third favourite Vera Lindsay.
This is a book called Aristotle's Masterpiece, a previously banned Georgian sex manual that is now up for sale. The sex manual was recently handed into an auction house by a lovely old lady who looked absolutely knackered. The manual advises that you shouldn't mate with animals, but I think we've had enough of experts, haven't we? One piece of advice is try a bit of role play. Imagine one of you has the plague and the other has to dig a grave. Women are encouraged to lie on their left side if they want a girl, lie on their right side if they want a boy, and lie about having syphilis if they just want to be left alone. 2 points to Katie. Andy, have a listen to this.
The ants go marching one by one, hoorah, hoorah. The ants go marching one by one, hoorah, hoorah. The ants go marching one by one, the little one stops to suck his thumb, and they all go marching down to the ground. Get out of the rain.
Boom, boom, boom. Andy, who's been helpful at an anti-war demonstration?
Right, well, there's an incredible piece of science that has emerged this week, Miles. Science, for once, has taken a break from very important research into why eating sausages is, like, in terms of health, going over the top of the Battle of Passchendaele wearing a luminous codpiece, to do some genuine research into in which they've discovered that ants provide free healthcare to each other in battlefield situations. So they managed to discover that ants, in their regular battles with termites, actually go out and rescue the injured ants and nurse them back to health, like some sort of Florence Nightingale. it's half crowd. It doesn't say whether or not the ants then provide psychological aftercare or if the injured ants are just forgotten about and become marginalised in society. So I think there's still some things they could learn from humans as a species. Or whether the ants are any good at negotiating a peace, because it's all very well going out and rescuing the injured ants, but if they're having, as the research shows, 2 to 4 battles against termites a day, surely at some point they have to start thinking, is this in anyone's long-term best interest?
What's quite sweet is that once an ant has had more than three legs bitten off and then can't stand, they will reject help. They just flap, they say, "I'm a goner, I'm afraid. Leave me behind. Save yourselves. It's a trap." And they just they reject the help because the other ones, I mean, and they do it by licking. Because, I mean, you know, we talk about people licking their wounds. They actually, so presumably ants, because I think all animals, we are the only animals that don't use our tongues in a medical or hygiene based way because they all.
Oh,
I mean,
you
like,
old smoothie, Jeremy. Well, like,
cats, for example, will clean their bottom and then within seconds do the same thing to your face. We're learning more and more that animals have skills that we didn't... Like, you know, people have realised that chimpanzees can fashion simple tools and that horses and dogs have emotional intelligence and that fish can use lawnmowers. Now it seems that ants are just like, incredible. And by licking the thing, it's got some antimicrobial properties.
Well, aren't human mouths full of bacteria? I'm fairly sure I heard that if you go to A&E, it's much worse if you've been bitten by a human than a dog.
Is it? Oh, it's like one of those things that apparently you should wash your hands. Graham Gardner told me this. You should wash your hands, if you're a gentleman, before you go to the lavatory, because your hands are much filthier than your schmeckle. That's been safely in your pants all day.
I think this was advice that he took you aside in particular to say. Jeremy, I haven't been sitting next to you all afternoon. I have noted the state of your hands. You really do not touch yourself with that.
It does also suggest that ants have yet to develop the lawyer. and that they just go out and provide healthcare without thinking about the potential legal consequences if it goes wrong. Should science not be doing something more important with its time than watching ants and termites smash the shit out of each other?
They put 3D goggles on praying mantises last week. There is a high banter level happening among insect scientists where they just kind of go, what if we just took a spider and gave it alcohol? I mean, that's another thing that they have done. They gave spiders a load of different drugs to see how it affected their webs. And unsurprisingly, if you give a spider like LSD, then it comes up with a really trippy web. And I don't think we're learning anything specifically from it, but it is kind of hilarious.
It's like when you put a tin can on a kitten's head.
It's
hysterical, but also research. Because they bounce off the walls like pinballs, and then you take it off after a bit.
What experiments would the panel be prepared to take part in to further science?
Wow. I've always thought sleep research sounded quite fun. I mean, basically, they say, do you want to come and sleep for 8 hours in the laboratory? And you think, yeah, it's probably a lot quieter than it is in my flat.
But you're watched the entire time. Would that not make it harder to sleep?
I've got a husband. I'm watched already. I mean, if you wanted to sleep in solitary seclusion, you'd have to live alone.
Presumably he doesn't just watch you. I think I slept right through last night. You did. That's right, yeah. All right.
I'd love to take LSD under clinical conditions. I've always thought I'd really enjoy that.
Well, let's see if we can sort that for
you. I'm very curious about LSD, but I'm too frightened to just take it on my own because I'm too square to just do it like at a festival.
You'd rather do it in a laboratory than
the
field.
Would. Yeah, I like just have experts around. I am not tired of experts at all.
Don't you think a place full of people in sort of white coats and gloves is exactly what you don't want when you're on LSD?
No,
I'm trapped in a laboratory. You are trapped in a laboratory.
Yeah.
People in white coats and gloves, that to me just says cricket, frankly.
Andy, what medical experiments haven't you subjected yourself to as part of your relentless pursuit for cash?
I would like to be part of an experiment to see how much televised sport one person can humanly watch before they lose all contact with reality.
You're sort of doing that experiment.
Yes,
anyway.
I am. I'm selflessly doing that.
It's just not peer reviewed.
Yeah. No, it's wife reviewed.
These are the Matabele ants of the Ivory Coast, who it appears have their own altruistic system of healthcare. When ants are injured in attacks on termite mounds, other ants will retrieve them, carry them back to the nest, and nurse them back to health. The study of ants is, of course, a difficult and intricate process, not least because every time you get the magnifying glass out, they all start bursting into flames. The ants treat each other's wounds with intensive licking. I should point out that normally, if that's the sort of treatment the nurse prescribes, you're probably not in a clinic. Of course, let's not forget all those ants who stand at the sidelines during all of the fighting, holding up little bits of leaf with "When will the madness end?" written on them. The ants indicate they're in distress by releasing pheromones. Every species has its own way of issuing a cry for help. For some, it's the pheromones. For others, it's reading a series of pre-prepared jokes on the radio. 2 points to Andy. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting that they would like to share? Jeremy.
Miles, this is actually a notice on the wall of the lavatory backstage, which I will put back after the show. And it says, the use of nicotine vaporising devices is prohibited in these premises as it might activate the fire alarm, causing an evacuation.
Helen.
This is from The Eye on Tuesday, and it was sent in by Elizabeth Gatland of Perth. A local politician has said that wild boars should be given contraceptive pills to control Belgium's population.
Katie.
This was sent in by Alan Lewis, who saw it in The Telegraph earlier this week. The number of women having breast enlargements rose by 7%. The figures are from the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, or BAPS.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final score. Jeremy and Helen have 9, but this week's winners are Katie and Andy with 10. Before we leave you, here is something spotted on South Western Railway's Twitter feed by Peter Denton in Teddington.
Between Monday the 12th and Friday the 16th of February, we will be improving our smart card systems. This means you will not be able to purchase any smart card products on our station ticket machines.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Helen Lewis, Katie Brand and Andy Zaltzman. In the chair was Miles Jupp and the news was read by me, Cathy Cluxton. The chair script was written by James Keppel, Robin Morgan and Sarah Morgan, with additional material by Sophie Duker and Mike Shepherd. The producer was Richard Morris and it was a BBC Studios production.